From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Can you remember your first experience with Jell-O? Well, you might associate the jiggly, colorful dessert with childhood memories. But for Allie Rowbottom, the history of Jell-O is a more complicated story.
I hadn't really intended to tell the story of American feminism through the lens of Jell-O.
Allie Rowbottom is a descendant of the Jell-O family. In her new book, Jell-O Girls, she tells the story of how her forebears marketed Jell-O as a product of convenience for American housewives, a strategy that ensured the brand's success for generations. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, it's an incredible book, so fascinating. How are you related to Jell-O?
So my great-great-great uncle bought the patent to Jell-O from its inventor in 1899. And I always feel the need to clarify, he was my uncle by marriage. So I say in the book it was by luck, really, and by marriage that my family came into this great Jell-O legacy and its attendant traumas, perhaps.
Who was the man who sold the patent to your family?
The man who sold the patent was named Pearl Bixby Waite, and he was a patent medicine maker in Leroy, New York. But he was struggling to get by. He just couldn't get a break, and he started playing around with unflavored powder gelatin and adding the flavor that he would normally use for patent medicines to the gelatin. And then his wife, May, would sort of play around with it. Together, they came up with the name Jell-O and then sold it to Orator Francis Woodward.
Because before there was powder gelatin, people who made gelatin would have to slave over hot stoves with calves' hooves, and it was not pretty.
No, it was an arduous process. It took days. I mean, it was hot, hot work. Because of that, gelatin was really confined to the aristocracy, either in Europe or eventually when it came over to America.
So let's jump way forward just for a minute.
Sure.
Who are the Jell-O girls?
Well, the Jell-O girl was a little girl named Elizabeth King who became the face of Jell-O for a period of time in the early 1900s. The idea behind her representation of the brand being that the brand was so easy, even a child could make it, and selling Jell-O based on ease and convenience was a major tenet of their marketing campaigns at that time. So in my family and in this book, the Jell-O girls pertain to myself, my mother, my grandmother, any woman connected to Jell-O, but then ultimately any woman in America, really. This idea of trauma and how it's passed down through my family and through this idea of a Jell-O curse ultimately becomes more collective to the female experience than maybe my mother or myself had originally believed.
Yeah, it's as if Jell-O and the culture of the 20th century, early 20th century, are a stand-in for the overriding patriarchal culture of the nation, and in particular, a certain class.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that was something that revealed itself to me in the writing of the book in some ways. I wasn't quite sure how Jell-O fit in exactly, but once I started researching its marketing campaigns and really just its general history, I saw the ways in which Jell-O traced American feminism and the history of American femininity and housework and domestic science in a way that really meant that it also revealed the overriding patriarchal structures, as you say, of the country.
Your mother was really hesitant to discuss your connection to Jell-O. And in fact, you talk about how your month together on Weight Watchers is the only time you made the dessert together. Why did she evade the subject?
I think that she was so conflicted herself about it. I mean, I say in the book, my mother was an artist and had wanted to make art and live a life outside of what she saw as sort of patriarchal expectations that went along with her gender and to a certain extent her class. And she struggled to reconcile the fact that she came from so much privilege and also, you know, had these ideals that sort of ran in contradiction to it, I guess.
So interesting. Throughout the book, you go through these chapters of deep sort of dive into your own personal story and the story of your mother and your grandmother. And then those are interspersed with a look at Jell-O and what Jell-O was within a certain time within American society. How did the messaging for Jell-O adapt to the evolving role of women in the 20th century from post-World War II housewife to liberated modern woman.
Sure. I mean, the messaging sometimes struggled and sometimes really successfully adapted to women shifting roles in society. For example, you know, during the Second World War, when rationing was a concern, the, you know, advertisements really stressed the imperative to make the Jell-O that was available go even further. Jell-O as a food stretcher was really popular for a while. But then once sort of a more stable era of American history came about, Jell-O really pushed itself on women as an emblem of the domestic science movement, or a way through which women could appropriately feed and nourish and positively influence the family unit, and in so doing, positively influence the country as a whole. And it was sort of women's duty to do so.
One of my favorite things you brought up was how cooking is often very messy and animals are messy. And the idea of embedding, and I remember this, like, let's say, a fillet of salmon and hiding it within a Jell-O mold that is shaped like a fish.
Mm-hmm.
Is sort of like this amazing, like, you know, a perfection salad kind of thing.
Sure. I mean, in so many ways, the more natural the food item was at that particular period of time, which was mostly in the 1950s and early 60s, the more natural the food source was, the more it needed to be hidden.
And then there was this really interesting period as feminism and the liberated women started to emerge, where Jell-O had to recalibrate what it was about. And some of those campaigns were just disastrous.
Absolutely. I mean, it really did try, particularly during the divorce boom of the 70s, to market itself to newly independent women, but oftentimes to disastrous ends. And not till after attempting to urge women sort of back into the kitchen. It was sort of like a last ditch effort on Jell-O's part to market itself to cosmopolitan women.
But some of those campaigns, the ones where it would show a woman, a very modern woman, holding up a Jell-O mold of some kind or another, and then there would be a sentence. Do you remember any of—
Absolutely. So in these images, the woman is sort of looking up at the camera as if looking up to a husband and presenting a what seems like a conciliatory Jell-O mold in some ways, and saying, you know, in quoted text at the bottom, something sort of apologetic or placating, like, oops, I backed the car out of the driveway and hit another car, honey, or like— All of these attempts of women in these advertisements to gain freedom were thwarted, and the underlying message being because women weren't adequately equipped to have lives and autonomy outside of their husband's purview. So they had to apologize for the mistakes they inevitably made out in the world by making Jell-O.
And then, of course, the jigglers came along, and there became Jell-O as snack food. And then there started to be this other shift where, though its original audience was women, Jell-O kind of became tainted by its history with shots in fraternity houses. And then, of course, came Bill Cosby.
Yep.
Which was a boon when first introduced. So how has it sort of managed to weave its way through those?
I'm not sure if it has, quite honestly. I think that the company is struggling. I mean, I'm not privy to its inner workings, of course, but I have noticed that the Jell-O section in my local pavilions or whatever has shrunk quite sizably. I know that the sort of contemporary push towards whole foods, natural foods, has been problematic for Jell-O. You know, the product is still full of sugar and dyes and chemicals. Although I will say that it does seem to me that the biggest market for Jell-O currently is with dieters, and it remains sort of a low point Weight Watchers food, the sugar-free varieties anyways.
What's really interesting to me about your title, Jell-O Girls, is there's another set of girls from Leroy, New York, who were said to have had conversion disorder or, quote, hysteria. Could you talk a bit about those girls, when it happened?
So the symptoms began in October of 2011 and then extended into 2012. And they began in sort of a small group of girls, close friends. And they were Tourette's-like symptoms with no known physical cause. Then those symptoms spread and they started to affect people outside of these girls' social circle within the town of Leroy. By the end, women, full-grown women, were affected rather than just girls. At the time, the story became an object of fascination for my mother and then ultimately for me, I think because she felt that she knew what was going on and that the same sort of thing had happened to her as a girl living in Leroy. And she traced the girl's symptoms to physical and involuntary expression of the trauma of being a girl in a hyper-patriarchal environment.
Well, it's a fascinating book. Thank you so much, Allie.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Allie Rowbottom. Her book is called Jell-O Girls. As many of you know, our great tortilla tournament is heating up. This week, we narrowed our contestants down to 16 tortilla makers. In a moment, Gustavo Arellano joins me with some color commentary. Stick around.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. This week, the 64 tortilla makers in our great tortilla tournament were whittled down to the suave 16. And there have been some surprise upsets that might have turned your brackets upside down. Our contest host, Gustavo Arellano, is here to break down the action so far. So, where are we at?
I say the suave 16. We're now at the 16 finalists. We're reduced to 8 flour tortillas and 8 corn tortillas, broken up into 4 brackets. Yourself has one on the corn. Nick, your producer, is on the other corn. Connie Alvarez from KCRW has 1 flour, and then I have the other flour.
So what's happened in the flour end of this contest? I feel like I'm out of touch with you guys.
Just to give an overall sense of what we're seeing in corn and flour, on the corn side, which we'll get to in a bit, but you're really seeing some of those classic makers, those mass producers, the people that have been in Southern California for 40, 50 years, advancing. And I think that really speaks to the quality overall of corn tortillas in Southern California. It's a really, in some ways, it seems interesting. All you need to make a good corn tortilla is corn, cal, which is the lime, and then add water, and then you have it. On flour tortilla, on our side of the bracket, on the other hand, the people who are emerging are new kids, people who have been doing flour tortillas no less than 5 years, but are really taking care with the quality of ingredients that they have. Meanwhile, the big flour tortilla makers, your Northgates and Romero's, which is a personal favorite of mine, Carrillo's as well in San Fernando, they're being eliminated. So it seems that in corn, you can make mass-produced corn tortillas and they're still going to be good, but when it comes to flour, it's a little bit harder.
What's interesting to me is that most of the entries on the corn side weren't handmade. We're almost all dealing with machine, except for one or two.
Yeah, that was the sort of the conundrum when we were choosing, or specifically me choosing the entries. It's like, how much handmade restaurant tortillerias do we want? And I would argue the reason why I wanted to do a lot of the more machine-bought ones is because almost all of these restaurants, they're buying their masa from somewhere. It's very rare the restaurants that make their own masa just and Nick's tamales their own corn just because it's so labor-intensive. Taco Maria, which is in Nick's side of the bracket, they're the number one seed. Everyone loves their corn tortillas. Well, people don't realize Carlos Salgado, he nixtamalizes all that blue corn every single morning, and they make amazing tortillas, but to be able to scale that, it's really, really hard. So, you know, on the other hand, you have like one of them, my personal favorite corn tortilla in Southern California, which is in your bracket, and I'm glad it made it into the Suave 16, Miramar Tortilleria in East Los Angeles. They're mass producers. They've been around since the 50s, but I don't know how, but they just nail it.
So let's go through and just tell us who the Suave 16 are and who are going up against each other.
Okay, so in your bracket, it's going to be number one seed La Princesita from East LA against La Corona of Sylmar. And then on the other two you have is Kernel of Truth, who makes non-GMO, fresh, and they only make them 3 times a week tortillas against an interesting one, La Mazorca of Riverside. So it's really interesting that Riverside is in this conversation because we always forget about the Inland Empire. On Nick's side of the bracket, Taco Maria versus one that I found at the last moment, Tortilleria La Fiesta from Long Beach. The other bracket is Miramar tortillas. So you didn't have Miramar, but I know you've tasted them because I give them to you. Miramar Tortilleria against Guisados. You know, this long-standing Boyle Heights. Now it's a chain restaurant that does make their tortillas fresh every day.
And then give us a rundown of the flour.
So flour, Connie has Burritos La Palma versus Mexicali Taco. That's going to be a great matchup. The other one, the only Tex-Mex entry and one of the few Tex-Mex-style tortillas, flour tortillas in Southern California, home state. So we're talking thick, powdery. I love them. A lot of Californians hate on them because they've never tasted them. Against Jimenez Market. Jimenez Market is this interesting little mini chain with outpost in Pomona and Santa Ana. They only make their tortillas every Thursday, flour. It's a bunch of women doing them around one of those big, huge comales, and they're just absolutely amazing. And then on my side, La Azteca Tortilleria in East LA, longtime standard, versus La Monarca, the very famous panaderia, who actually a couple years ago started making their own flour tortillas. And then the other two, this one's going to be a good one, Salazar, which is a sister restaurant, Mexicali Taco, versus Sonora Town in downtown LA.
Amazing. Well, we're very excited to see who wins. Thank you so much, Gustavo.
Gracias.
I've been talking to Gustavo Ariano about his great tortilla tournament. Be sure to visit kcrw.com/tortilla next Wednesday so you can see who's moving on to the next round. Yep, it'll be the Elote 8. And be sure to RSVP for our award celebration on September 16th. I'm sure that many of you plan to spend your Labor Day gathered near a barbecue grill in a park or a backyard. But besides hot dogs, corn, and burgers, have you ever considered grilling dessert?
You need moisture, and anything that has a lot of moisture in it will grill beautifully.
That's Valerie Gordon. She's the pastry and chocolate mastermind of Valerie Confections here in LA. And we've been talking about her latest obsession, making desserts on the grill.
Really?
Really.
I have to admit that a million years ago when I wrote a cookbook called Cucina Fresca, like 1984, I think that I actually tested some grilled fruit for that book, particularly grapes. That's not what you're talking about.
No, I'm talking about doing full desserts on the grill. And it is something that came about through a growing obsession that I have with barbecue.
So let's talk about that for a minute. How did that begin?
My obsession with barbecue began when I went on book tour in 2013. And I look at my calendar, and I'm going to Texas by myself for 9 days. And all I could think was, what the hell am I going to do in Texas by myself for 9 days and go around and do these cooking demos? And as I was about to leave for the airport, and I grabbed an issue of Savor that was all about Texas, and I relished that issue of Savor on the plane. And during my flight, I became completely fixated with this ritual of barbecue. Those 9 days were a really, really seminal lesson for me in Texas barbecue.
I love that you did that while you were on book tour.
Because I need a project, Evan.
So did you start trying to make your own barbecue when you got home, or did you just start to search for local barbecue masters?
I just wanted to be around it and eat it more and absorb the energy that happens around barbecue because it's distinct. And there is something that is so fundamentally social and sharing about barbecue that I realized I craved on some level. Something about working in pastry is I think you become sort of sequestered in these kitchens a little bit, and everything gets a little bit isolated, particularly as you're growing a company, because your life turns into, you know, group emails and conference calls. And every time I went out to eat barbecue, I was like, it's nice being in public and having a group of people hanging out and eating off this grill and talking and sharing. It's just a wonderful way to share food. So eating barbecue just became more and more present in my life, and really trying to find the best barbecue anywhere that I went, and particularly in Los Angeles. And then, you know, sort of being like a freaky fan is the best way that I can put it. And downloading pictures of barbecue and texting people about barbecue. And it just went on and on. And then I kind of thought, I want to imply myself on this community and participate. And the most natural way for me to do that is through dessert.
So when I think about using a grill for dessert, I think about that it's basically a barbecue with a lid becomes basically a smoky oven.
It does become a smoky oven, but it depends what kind of grill you use. And I am an advocate for the Big Green Egg, and I really do find that this is, and I know there are other kinds of Komodo grill oven contraptions. This is the only one I've ever used, and I find it works really, really well. And it works well because it's sort of like a very basic convection oven. And you've got two vents of heat that you can control, and it also sustains a specific temperature for a lengthy amount of time, which is great. You know, the more I sort of looked into grilled desserts, barbecue desserts, what I did find is all I could find were grilled fruits. And I thought, no, let's have fun here. Let's play with some things. And the more I played, the more I sort of fell in love with the flavors that were developing off of the grill, and the complexity and also the texture that you get in a dessert is magnificent.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Take one dessert and talk to me about how the texture is different.
So something like a brownie. So I'm just sort of like, I'm throwing all my fetishes into one place with these grilled desserts. And something else that I really, really love is super intense salty French butter. So I'm using cast iron skillets and Rudolf Meunier's Beurre de Barat. I just put like an obscene layer of this butter on everything that I cook on the grill. So it's almost like a super gentle fry that you're getting.
Because you're greasing the pan.
You're greasing it with like a like really a rude amount of delicious salty French butter. And so what you get, like for instance with a brownie, right? The first brownie I did this with, I was like, holy hell, I can't stop eating this thing. This is so good. And you get like that really intense, greasy, crusty exterior, and then it's so moist and yielding on the inside, and you're absorbing those smoke flavors in it. And you can't get that in a normal oven. It's a thrill.
So tell me how the smoky flavor like enlivens the chocolate rather than sort of plays against it.
Well, I, you know, in general, I like the flavor of smoke on dessert. There's a cookie that I've made for years called the Durango cookie and has smoked salt on it. So that essence of smoke, and with dessert, you can add different chips to your mix with whatever charcoal, whatever briquette you're using. You can get that smoked flavor in there as well by using apple chips, whatever it is, you know what I mean? And so it gets that underbelly. It's that really infectious outdoor cookery smell, taste, aroma that is fabulous.
So tell me about the first time you brought this barbecue brownie setup to a convivial space.
So I do this outside of our Echo Park Cafe. It is a thing, and I'm there every Saturday grilling desserts, and I grill different things. I grill clafoutis. I've been doing
a— What is a clafoutis?
A clafoutis is a wonderful custard-based dessert that is almost like a souffle, and it puffs up beautifully in any oven, and it was made super famous by Julia Child. And it's the simplest recipe. It has sugar. It has egg, flour, milk. You mix those things together, you pour it in a pan, you add fruit, it puffs up, you wait till it browns, and you've got a gorgeous bistro-style dessert. So I spinned it a little bit by putting it on a grill. So something like that bakes off beautifully. Anything really, any sort of really wet custard base. So any kind of
a bread
cake,
pudding.
A bread. I've done a lot of bread pudding. Sticky toffee pudding is fabulous. A pot au creme works really well on a grill.
And what about caramel?
Caramel is the best on the grill because, again, there's two different methods of cooking caramel, right? You've got the wet method, you've got the dry method. I always do the dry method where you're just starting with sugar in a pot. And those smoky notes get completely absorbed in the sugar. And it just tastes like fire and nature and happy.
Wow.
You want it.
Well, right now, my stomach is just like, I want the brownie.
So really, but anything, just to liberate people who are grill curious, as I was, anything that has a lot of liquid in the recipe, you can put on the grill.
I cannot wait to try this. Yeah. Thank you so much, Valerie.
Thank you, Evan.
That was pastry mastermind Valerie Gordon of Valerie's here in Los Angeles. We've been talking about her latest obsession, which is grilling her desserts, and just in time for Labor Day. After the break, we turn to global warming. Did we miss our chance to do something about it? I'm joined by writer Nathaniel Rich when Good Food continues. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Since the Industrial Revolution, the Earth has warmed up more than 1 degree Celsius. Scientists say a degree or two more would mean the loss of coral reefs and possibly entire coastal cities. But could we have done anything to stop it?
There's no conversation we have today about this subject that wasn't being had verbatim in 1980.
That's Nathaniel Rich. He recently wrote an incredible article for the New York Times Magazine about a crucial window in our history when we could have acted on climate change. Written with support from the Pulitzer Center, the piece took up an entire edition of the New York Times Magazine. It features photos by George Steinmetz. Well, I have to say that reading your article is just devastating on so many levels.
It's devastating to research and report.
I can't imagine. So this term, greenhouse effect, you say that it dates back to the early 1900s. So back then, people already knew that the use of fossil fuels was starting to impact the environment?
Yeah, that was known really since 1896, when a Swedish chemist, Svante Arrhenius, put it together based on earlier research about what we now call greenhouse gases, molecules in the atmosphere that help warm the planet. And he realized then that burning of fossil fuels would increase the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and with that raise warming. But he, being in Sweden, wasn't too concerned about that, also not quite understanding how much fossil fuel we would be burning over the next century. But by 1957, really, there's a very clear understanding, certainly at the highest levels of the U.S. government and the science community here, that we'd embarked on a grand experiment with our natural world, the ramifications of which we had no way of fully comprehending.
Who was the major person, and within what time frame was the scientific understanding strong enough that someone felt there needed to be a political response and worked hard to bring awareness of politicians that this was something to be concerned about?
So that's the subject of my story, really, and it's begins in 1979 when there's a strong consensus about the fundamental science of climate change. And the first group of environmentalists and activists, scientists and government bureaucrats begin to try to figure out a way to move the subject from science papers and science reports and intelligence reports to policy. The key figures in my piece are a activist named Rafe Pomerantz, who was then with Friends of the Earth, was kind of a lobbyist for the environment and had worked on the Clean Air Act, and also James Hansen, a NASA physicist who had studied Venus and the greenhouse effect. And so those two start a campaign that begins with having meetings first in government, concluding with a meeting at the Carter White House with his science advisor. And then they take it to Congress. Later, there's a kind of public information effort. And by the end of the decade, they've helped to formulate a framework for an international treaty to reduce carbon emissions. And we came to the precipice of signing a binding agreement like that at the end of the decade, only to fail.
It's shocking to know that we were that close to a binding agreement. Who kind of put the kibosh on that?
I mean, the short political answer is John Sununu, the chief of staff for George H.W. Bush. Bush had run as a self-proclaimed environmentalist in the campaign in 88 during the hottest summer on record when Jim Hansen testified to Congress and elevated the issue to front page, you know, national news. And he said on a campaign stop, I'm paraphrasing, but those who think that we can't solve the greenhouse effect haven't seen the White House effect. And when I'm in the White House, we will solve this. And so he comes to office with a lot of bold proclamations about this. And he's joined in this or you know, sort of the intellectual heart of this argument is being made within the administration by William Riley, who's the head of his EPA, Secretary of State Jim Baker, formerly Chief of Staff for Reagan, in his very first speech, gives, after confirmation, gives an impassioned endorsement of this international process, hosting a meeting of the IPCC, which had just formed, the global body tasked with trying to develop policy solutions for climate change. And John Sununu, the former governor of New Hampshire, PhD in engineering, becomes extremely skeptical of the science and is one of the only people to be skeptical of the science, but he occupies a position of power. After a kind of internal dogfight between him and mainly William Riley, he is able to force the U.S. not to agree to sign any kind of agreement or pledge to sign any kind of agreement that has targets. And that's the beginning of the unraveling. And then very shortly thereafter, industry mobilizes and begins their campaign of disinformation, PR, modeled after the tobacco industry's efforts, buying off politicians, buying off the Republican Party, paying scientists to give statements.
During that same period in the 80s, the major oil companies like Exxon and Shell actually were doing a lot of investigation themselves with the idea of trying to address these concerns. When did it shift for them of wanting to know the damage that they were doing to wanting to protect themselves from being blamed for the damage they were doing?
Well, I think they always wanted to protect themselves from being blamed for the damage they were doing, but I would distinguish between those efforts, which I think you could date back to the 50s, trying to understand the problem and understand the contribution of the fossil fuel industry, to the efforts that really sharply pivot, basically after the James Hansen hearing in 1988, to an effort to stress scientific uncertainty, to make sure that any regulations that were passed or even proposed didn't hurt the bottom line. And ultimately, that led into denialism. That didn't start for a few years later into the 90s. But as of 88, 89, you have the first internal policy papers coming out at Exxon, at the American Petroleum Institute, saying, you know, we need to participate in this conversation. It seems like there's going to be a lot of regulation coming soon in the Bush White House. And we need to be a party and we need to stress uncertainty and we need to make sure that any policies are business friendly, which of course means doesn't threaten profits. So that starts in 88 as it becomes a major national issue, but then it really takes off in the advance of the Rio Earth Summit in 1992, which is the final negotiation of the first climate treaty.
What really intrigues me is how you put into focus, on one hand, the emotional investment on the part of industry and government to the mantra that cheap energy equals economic well-being, and on the other hand, the more nuanced understanding of the future of the planet and our species.
The story of our species since the Industrial Revolution has been that our quality of life, by any index, whether it's, you know, diet, longevity, health outcomes, wealth, has correlated directly with our consumption of energy. And all of this time, we've been consuming energy that comes from fossil fuels predominantly. We've been running up a bill that only now is coming due. And I think we have to reckon with that reality. In addition to the reality of the political obstruction and the industry obstruction, we've been blithely discounting the future for generations and giving it little thought, even as we've understood intellectually what we've been doing.
Could you do me a favor, Nathaniel, and read the last paragraph of your piece?
If human beings really were able to take the long view, to consider seriously the fate of civilization decades or centuries after our deaths, we would be forced to grapple with the transience of all we know and love in the great sweep of time. So we've trained ourselves, whether culturally or evolutionarily, to obsess over the present, worry about the medium term, and cast the long term out of our minds as we might spit out a poison.
So according to current climate models, are we beyond any ability to affect a change?
No. Actually, Jim Hansen, one of the central figures in the piece, has a plan that he's laid out that begins in 2021, not coincidentally after Trump's first term ends. That would be a phasing in over 10 years of heavy investment in renewable energy development, a major push for nuclear power to replace coal, particularly in places like China. And that would involve sharing nuclear technology with China. and also investment in carbon capture technology, which is, you know, developing right now, and we've invested very little in it. So there's a sound economic argument to do it. There's a strong technological argument that it can be done, and this would keep warming within an acceptable range. But I've seen very little evidence of a human will to do it, human will that would be able to force the political process to make that kind of a transformation in a short amount of time, which is not to say it can't happen. I think the optimism is that there is a plan. I'm sure there are plenty of other plans as well. But I think there needs to be a major change in consciousness and really in establishing a moral vision of this problem in order for people to understand what's at stake and what can be done at this stage.
That's Nathaniel Rich, writer-at-large for the New York Times Magazine. His story with George Steinmetz, titled Losing Earth, was written with support from the Pulitzer Center. Now we turn to what some say is the future of farming. It involves all the trappings of a sci-fi flick: automation, mega warehouses, and artificial light. It's called vertical farming, and food and beverage writer Steve Holt recently wrote an article about it for Civil Eats. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Evan.
You know, it's so interesting. Every time I read about the great future promise of internal warehouses filled with greens, I think to myself, there has to be a different side to this story.
Yeah, no, you're right to ask that question and to have that thought. And that's precisely why I sort of began down this path of looking into this industry a little deeper, because so many of the reports I'd seen, some of the articles were just effusive in their positivity about this this industry. And, you know, I know that there was another side. So I set out to find it.
So explain how vertical farming, as it's called, is different from just good old-fashioned field farming or what we know as greenhouse farming.
So, you know, we all know that the way that farming has been done for thousands of years has been you put a seed into soil outdoors, and then a combination of the nutrients from the soil and the sunlight and rain, as well as some inputs, both organic and non-organic. That's how it's done. That's how it's been done. In the last 20 years or so, and really in the last 10 years, there have been some just unbelievable technological advances that have brought farming indoors. So of course, we've had greenhouses for a while that are essentially where some of the downsides of outdoor farming can be controlled a little bit more closely. You can sort of control the temperature. You can sort of control the moisture that is accessing the plants, and you can grow year-round. In the last maybe 10 years, though, there have been advances in what is called vertical farming, or controlled environment agriculture. What you typically see is these big, massive warehouses that are stacked floor to ceiling with these rows of sort of stacked on top of one another plants that are put into, it's not soil usually, it's some other kind of organic matter. There's not a bug to be seen, you know, in the entire facility. It's all artificial lighting, LEDs, and there's so much data that is taken to figure out how each plant can grow at its most efficient way. The temperature is closely controlled. They're pumping CO2 into these facilities. There are plant scientists just walking the rows of these. You have to suit up, you know, into this big sort of space age ET looking costume to even get near these plants, because they are so highly controlled, and sort of any outside, you know, influence can really change the dynamic of a particular pod or room that is growing plants these ways.
And what is typically being grown in these environments?
We've had tomatoes being grown indoors, usually in greenhouses, at a larger scale for many years now. I think I read somewhere that like up to half of the tomatoes we Americans consume are now grown indoors in these greenhouses. What's typically grown in the vertical farms, in the sort of more soilless farms, are leafy greens primarily, as well as herbs. So things like kale, arugula, lettuce, you know, the various lettuce varieties. But then there are some companies that are starting to sort of delve into some different types of varieties of vegetables.
Is the quality of the end result very different from traditional growing methods? And also from a nutrient point of view, you know, one always has heard that plants need to struggle to create some of the antioxidants and the robust flavors. And one would imagine that a goal of these indoor environments is to keep plants from being as stress-free as possible.
That's a great question, and one that we don't have very many good answers for. You know, when you talk to the vertical farmers, these sort of techie leaders in this industry, you know, they promise that the quality is better. They promise that the taste is better and that it is more nutrient dense. Their evidence on that, however, is not from usually, at least from what they're revealing to the public and to reporters, is not usually based on a scientific analysis of the nutrient content of plants, but rather this sort of A plus B equals C equation of when you transport a plant, you know, fewer miles from where it's grown to where it is eaten, you lose fewer nutrients as a result. And so a big sort of selling point on the vertical farm movement is that these vertical farms are able to be built where outdoor farms have not been able to be built. So in cities and on the very close outskirts of cities, making leafy greens and other crops more readily accessible, bringing them closer into the folks that are eating them. You know, one of the questions I had for these vertical farmers is show me the scientific evidence for the greater nutrient density of these vegetables, for better quality. And that's what they told me. And there are scientists now that are out there that are going to be studying for the first time, really, the nutrient content of field-grown vegetables versus greenhouse vegetables versus vertically grown vegetables.
So they have a huge startup cost, really large energy ongoing costs. They have an enormous carbon footprint. And I would imagine that the result of all of those things is that it's not inexpensive, the produce.
It's not. Again, just to compare. So let's take kale, you know, one of our favorite leafy greens. So a traditional, conventionally grown pound of kale at Walmart will cost around $1.33 to $1.33. Organic kale, let's say from Walmart or Whole Foods, is going to be in the $4 to $5 per pound range. And vertically grown kale is going to be in the $13 to $15 per pound range. So that's, you can see that's a really big gap in price.
I mean, I don't want to be super cynical, but it's an industry that's being created by the tech industry, funded by venture capitalists for a very, very small population of people.
Well, they wouldn't say that. Some will say that this is a premium product that they're making. Others have worked pretty hard to get the cost for production down into the range that it costs to grow, you know, the same head of lettuce outdoors. But no, I think that you're right in saying that, first of all, it's not penetrating, you know, the outdoor grown lettuce market in any noticeable form yet. And they definitely are seizing on some of the scandals of the last few years, especially, you know, most recently the E. coli outbreak for romaine that was grown in Arizona. They love those types of stories because they say, look, here's what happens when you don't control the environment. You know, you can get people very, very sick and even people will die.
That's food and beverage writer Steve Holt. To read his story on vertical farming for Civil Eats, head to the Good Food website. Now we're on our way to the Santa Monica Farmers Market for a visit with Laura Avery.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm happy to be standing here at the Farmers Market with Noelle Carter, who is the LA Times Test Kitchen Director. Hi there, Noelle. You've seen Noelle's stories in the LA Times. She does a produce feature to tell you what's in season. She is now getting all geared up for the LA Times food
It's our 9th annual Taste Food Festival. Can you believe it? 9 years
no,
already?
I can't. No, you look way too young.
Thank you.
And you're at the market today. We love having you here. You're here all the time.
It's my favorite place to be.
You're going to be looking for ingredients that you will be cooking at the food festival. So tell us what you're shopping for and maybe what a recipe might be.
You know, I have to be a little honest right now because we're still figuring out exactly what we're going to be cooking. But I have to say, I was just at one of the stands and they had incredible black-eyed peas, which, you know, it's a member of the bean family. And right now, summer, it's great bean season for fresh and shelling beans. And so I'm going to pick up some Romano beans and probably get some of those black-eyed peas, too.
Okay, now the black-eyed peas, I know the farmer you're talking about, they're still in the pod and they just basically look like bumpy green beans. And I think a lot of people are confused about the difference between a shelling bean and then a whatever a green bean is. What's the difference?
The fresh beans, you can kind of divide them into two categories. You've got the round beans, like, your haricot vert and your regular green beans. And then you've got your flat beans, which are kind of like the Romano beans. And then you've got your shelling beans, which traditionally, you know, you dry them out and then you rehydrate them and you use them in soups or stews or whatnot. Cranberry beans, black-eyed peas, even though they're called black-eyed peas, are actually a bean that originated in China and India, I believe. Mm-hmm. But yeah, shelling beans, you can save them to use kind of any time throughout the year.
So once they're out of the shell, you've got all these nice fresh shelling beans. They're not dried. They're still considered fresh. What's the cooking time on those?
A lot shorter than it would be if they were dried because you don't have to hydrate them so much.
And you just boil them in water?
I just boil them in water. Sometimes if they're fresh enough, you know, I might just put them in a skillet with a little chicken broth or something and almost, you know, kind of saute them a little bit.
So at the LA Times Taste, you're going to be doing a Southern cooking demo? Or are these black-eyed peas going to make an appearance?
Oh, man, that would be really, really nice. So I'm really excited this year because we're going to be doing this Southern-themed demo, and I'm going to be doing it with Sean Lowenthal, who's the owner of Little Beast Restaurant in Eagle Rock. And we're still deciding on what we're going to demo, and so it's going to be a surprise. You got to show up, but no big reveals here just yet. But I just did a story on alternative hummuses for the LA Times about a month ago, and he provided one of the recipes, and it was this black-eyed pea hummus with a Hop and John salsa. And it's such a great recipe, and I got so much great reader response from it that I'll probably be using those black-eyed peas for that this weekend.
Let's just talk for a minute about what hummus is. Of course, we all know the garbanzo beans. You put it in a blender, you add whatever. What is in your black-eyed pea hummus?
So traditionally with the hummus, your base is the garbanzo beans and then a tahini paste, which is a sesame-based paste. Sean, in his recipe, doesn't use garbanzos at all. He uses cannellini beans along with the black-eyed peas. And so it's a little different. He's still got that tahini paste, so you've got those nice, nutty undertones, which work really, really well with the beans. But it's kind of got the southern flair to it, which is really nice.
I can't help but think that pretty much any bean that you cook and get to the right consistency, you could make a hummus with.
You know, I interviewed so many LA-based chefs just to see kind of the different takes, because I've seen so many different types of hummuses on menus. And gosh, I must have heard about 50 different varieties using everything from any and all different types of beans to, we actually did a beet-based hummus, which I found was a really nice spread with a little goat cheese on crostini.
Noelle, tell us some more about what's happening this weekend at the Taste.
Oh my gosh, so it's 3 days, of course. We had last night, kicked it all off, Paramount Backlot Studios. We've got just a bunch of different cooking events, unlimited food samples and drink samples, and so come hungry and thirsty and plan to have a lot of fun.
Do you have to get tickets?
You do.
Okay.
LATimes.com/thetaste.
Okay. All right. And all of our chefs, a lot of our produce is going to be there.
Over 100 chefs and restaurants will be represented. Mm-hmm. A number of demos. You're going to learn a lot and you're going to be, you know, filling your stomach while you're doing it. So it's going to be good.
That was Noelle Carter, and she is the director of the LA Times Test Kitchen. And she will be down holding forth at a booth at the LA Times Taste. And please do stop down and follow her in the LA Times. I'm over here now at Two Peas in a Pod, visiting with Zach, who is the farmer's son. His mom, Lori, is the berry lady, and Zach is the bean guy. And Zach, you're standing in front of some tubs of some beautiful, colorful, they look like jelly beans. They're beautiful. So tell us a little bit about what kind of beans you grow and why you grow the varieties you grow.
So we have a lot of different types of beans here. To start off, my grandpa started here about 35 years ago. He was known as the bean old man. He's still with us, but we kind of took it over for him now. We have green bean type beans, and then we have a lot of fresh shelling beans, and then of course we have our fresh dried beans.
So the difference between a fresh shelling bean and a fresh dried bean, all these are out in a tub. They all look like dried beans, but they're not that old. Is that the difference? They're fresh dried beans?
I call ours fresh dried beans because whatever does it sell on the table, we go home, put them out on a tarp, and wait a few days. The sun dries the pot out. And then what my grandpa used to do back in the day is he would run him over with a tractor or hit him with a stick, and he would get all the beans out that we would have to sort them and, you know, get all the pod debris out. Now we are a little more sophisticated. We have my little brother put him in a sheller, and he's the bean sheller of the family. And yeah, it works great.
Okay, and on your table here, I see 1, 2, 3, 4, about 7 tubs, and each one of them has a different kind of bean in it.
Yeah, like I said, we have a lot of different varieties of dried beans here. We probably grow about 16 or 17 beans on the farm. As for fresh shelling beans, about 6 or 7 varieties shelling beans. We bring in Christmas Lima, Ohawkins. The fan favorite is, of course, cranberry bean. My favorite is the Scarlet Runner due to the colors, the meatiness of the bean. It's just like a giant black bean, and it comes in purple and gray and all these different crazy colors. It's the prettiest bean and, you know, the coolest in my opinion.
Okay, and do every one of these beans have a different flavor profile, or somebody's asking you, oh, I want something creamy, or I want something nutty, or I want something, you can describe to them what the flavor profiles are?
So easy way to put it is there's 3 different types of bean categories. There's a red bean, a white bean, and a black bean. Red bean's right there in the middle, creamy and nutty. White bean is, of course, creamy. And then black bean is nutty and, you know, another really important thing is texture. Texture is almost more important than the taste. So here we do an easy thing called a 1-chew bean, a 2-chew bean, or a 3-chew. The Scarlet Runners or Mauve Runners that we talked about earlier, the big beautiful beans, those are a 2-to-3-chew because the skin's nice and thick and it's a really hearty, meaty bean. Whereas, you know, the soft cannellini would be a 1-chew and creamy as can be.
That was Farmer Zach with 2 peas in a pod, and he is the bean guy, and he told us all about the beans he grows, and they're certainly worth at least looking at. They're beautiful. Come and talk to Zach. You get your 1-chew, you get your 2-chew, and you can try experimenting for yourself. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Coming up, I'm talking with writer Tin Nguyen about Jonathan Gold's famous love for San Gabriel noodle shops. Stay with us. I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. We close out our show by remembering the late Jonathan Gold in his own words. This week, I'm talking with writer Tin Nguyen about one of her favorite Jonathan Gold reviews, about the Vietnamese noodle shop Na Trang in San Gabriel. The review that you chose of Jonathan's is one of my all-time favorites.
Oh, yeah?
Sure, because he addresses why noodles for all those readers who are just so frustrated with him.
Yes, and it's hard to imagine that there are readers like that, because for me, it's always why not noodles. But yeah, I love the way that he addresses people who think that he spent too much time in the San Gabriel Valley.
Yes.
And I love that as a reader, and I love that as a writer, the way he moves through his argument.
So what exactly are we reading?
We are reading Jonathan Gold's review of Nha Trang, which is a central Vietnamese restaurant in the San Gabriel Valley.
Is it still there?
It's still there. The review he has here is the first location. Since this review came out, they opened up a couple other spots. So I'm going to read from the very top of it. It has come to my attention that some of you think I have been paying too much attention to noodle shops in San Gabriel. And I realize, yes, I have been writing quite a bit about San Gabriel noodle shops lately. Although in my defense, I would point out that some of them are technically in Alhambra or Rosemead. San Gabriel noodle shops are a particular interest of mine, as you have probably determined, a subject I deem to be worth a lifetime of study. You may be wishing that I spent more time exploring the San Jose-based chain restaurants that populate the new Santa Monica Place, or the murderer's row of bad Italian restaurants in Brentwood. But we all have our weaknesses. This is mine. When I see all the new Dong Bai dives that I'll never get to, when I work through all the new dumpling places up on Las Tunas Avenue, I sometimes regret that I can't devote my entire life to the medium of wet, geographically inconvenient dough. I could probably point you to 20 or 30 San Gabriel noodle shops that I haven't had time to write about so far, pho counters and mee slingers and mian merchants, and I suspect each of them is more interesting than the latest bistro to open in Van Nuys. then he actually gets into his review.
That one line where he says, "I sometimes regret that I can't devote my entire life to the medium of wet, geographically inconvenient dough," is probably one of the greatest sentences ever written about noodles.
Yes, I agree.
So wonderful. So when we asked you to come up with a review that you loved, did you know immediately that this was going to be it?
Yes, because this is a review I go back to often, actually. As a reader, I loved it when I first read it. As a Vietnamese-American, I loved it. As an Asian-American, I loved it. As someone who loves noodles in the San Gabriel Valley, I loved it. You know, there's just the way he three-dimensionalizes noodle shops in the San Gabriel Valley. If you're used to reading about Asian noodles in other media, you kind of get the sense that to a lot of people, they're the same.
Yeah, they're completely replaceable one for another.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it seems like they're interchangeable. And the subject of this review, the dish that he really gets into here, is a dish called Bún Bao Huế, which is a Central Vietnamese soup noodle dish. And it's pork-based, has pork blood in it, it's beef meatballs, there's fermented shrimp paste involved. And often when you read about this elsewhere, it's compared to pho. You know, people call it the other pho. And that makes me so mad. It makes me so mad because it's so incorrect, right? These two dishes are totally different. But for whatever reason, it gets lumped in together. It gets compared to each other. And there's no distinctiveness that's given to them. And what Jonathan is doing in this review is that he's saying there are so many different types that he could spend his whole life exploring it. And as a reader, I'm like, yes, of course. You know, you just want to give him a high five and saying, thank you. That's exactly correct.
The other side of that coin is that he could eat and write about an infinite number of noodle places, and he chooses this one place which has one of the smallest menus ever, so small that they don't even have it written on paper.
Yes.
Which I love. So when you go there, what do you usually order?
I appreciate a Bún Bao Huế, but I have to confess it's not my favorite. I like their pho gà, which is their chicken pho. I think it's a really nice, clean version. It's really nice.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
Best writer Tin Nguyen. We've been talking about Jonathan Gold's review of Nha Trang from 2011. For more of our remembrances of Jonathan Gold, you can subscribe to our sibling podcast called Good Food on the Road. That's it for our show this week. If you missed any part of it, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher, and if you dug the show, leave us a review. We always love hearing from you. Many thanks to the Good Food team. They are Nick Liao, Rosalie Atkinson, Laryl Garcia, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.